Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, it's Jack. I'm reading some interesting articles from the November-December issue of Cowboys and Indians. Cole Hauser. The actor behind Yellowstone's now iconic character, Rip Wheeler, chats with CNI about the new season and other irons in his fire. By Joe Layden. Cole Hauser is on the line, calling from his home in Florida, while he enjoys some much-deserved R&R, after playing lead roles in two back-to-back feature films, Panama, an action-adventure in which he appears alongside Mel Gibson, and Mutti, a thriller co-starring Morgan Freeman, and, of course, completing season 4 of Yellowstone. But he's not so relaxed that he'll slip up and inadvertently reveal any of the surprises in store when Yellowstone returns to Paramount Network on November 7th. Heaven knows we tried to coax him, but just like ranch foreman Rip Wheeler, the complex character he vividly portrays on the series, Hauser likes to play his cards close to the vest. Fortunately, we found a way to have a mostly spoiler-free conversation. When we last saw Rip, he was kind of getting brushed off by Jamie, while other members of the Dutton family were under attack. You think you may end up having to take Jamie down to the train station as season 4 begins? Well, you'll have to watch. Did you have any major problems trying to film the season 4 episodes during the COVID-19 pandemic? We have a wonderful team in Paramount, and also in our crew and cast. We did everything that we could do to make sure everybody was safe. We stayed inside of a bubble. We didn't go out. Basically, it was work, go home, and cook, food, sleep, and do it all over again. Everybody prescribed to it, and thank God we got to be able to work in a time and environment while COVID was going on, not only in our business, but around the world. I know producer Taylor Sheridan swears all of you to secrecy when it comes to talking about future plot developments. But can you say anything about new things we might learn about Rip this season? Well, each year you get to know a little bit more about what makes him tick in his relationships, not only with John Dutton, but with Beth and her brothers, the guys in the bunkhouse. And Taylor does another wonderful job of kind of opening the onion when it comes to Rip's heart. There's a wonderful relationship, which I won't give away, with Beth and I that comes into our life. And again, it shows another side of not only Rip, but also Beth, and also John Dutton. So it's another excellent year of storytelling by Taylor Sheridan, and I'm looking forward to seeing what the audience thinks. One of the stranger moments in season 3 occurred in the episode where Rip exhumes the corpse of his long-dead mother, so he can retrieve a ring that he wants to give Beth. I can't help thinking it was very difficult to act that scene because, well, one false move. I thought it was a bit wild that Rip would do something like that. But as I got into the scene and started doing it as the actor, I made it into this beautiful moment, which I think is what Taylor wanted. And unfortunately, he wasn't there at the time, so it was me just working with Stephen Kay, the director, and breaking down what it was that Taylor was trying to do there. I felt like the right motivation for me was to make it a very beautiful, kind of heartfelt moment between my mother and me, versus the kind of goriness of digging up your mother, who's been buried for several years, and looking at it in a very negative way. I looked at it more as a positive. John Dutton is a man who demands absolute loyalty from the people who work his ranch. They're literally branded when they sign on and are forbidden to leave. and Rip serves as his enforcer. Would you agree that it's almost like the whole setup is a cult of sorts? I don't know if cult is the right word. It's more of a secret society in a way. A society that's probably been around not only throughout the history of the Dutton family, but prior to it. They've had this tradition that when you work on the ranch, you come here and you're branded as a man, and you die as a branded man. That's your allegiance to the family. But I wouldn't say cult. What has been the most surprising thing Taylor Sheridan has revealed to you about Rip? He surprises me all the time. I wouldn't say there's one thing that pops out. He's challenged me as an actor and challenged me as a man in this role, and I've challenged him back. It's part of the reason why I think not only the relationship with Taylor and I is strong, but also that the character has so many colors. What I've always wanted in Rip is the same as what Taylor's wanted, which is a multifaceted, extremely interesting, deep-thinking, heartfelt, strong American man. Taylor has said he doesn't want to reveal too much in advance to cast members about what's in store for them. Is that true? I can't speak for my other co-stars, but for me, I certainly take things in stride when it comes to reading his stuff. I don't ever jump ahead and read episode 10 before I get there, or 7 or 6 or 5. I'm somebody that enjoys the ride as an actor. I don't want to know what's going to happen next. For instance, last year was the first year that we all had the scripts up front, but I read them as we were filming them. That's how I like it. Other actors do different things. Some read them all in one day and knew the whole season and would come up to me and say, "Hey, did you?" And I'd say, "Don't tell me anything about that." So that's just how I am. I trust Taylor and that he's going to do something special, and that's the kind of belief I have in him. So you're experiencing the storyline the same way we are, watching each week. Yeah, I mean, I'm also creating as well as while I'm doing it, and I like to be focused on one thing at a time. I'm not trying to understand, okay, well, this happens 6x episodes ahead, then how am I going to play these moments now? I would like to play moment by moment and live in those moments as best I can and create and do the things that I should be doing as an actor in those moments. And after that's done, then I'll tackle the next. Do you remember the moment when you realized Yellowstone was such an enormous hit with audiences? When? After the first episode of the first season. I mean, it started at a very grassroots show. It obviously wasn't what it is now, but there were people throughout the country who were watching very closely right out of the gates. And I think a lot of that had to do with Kevin Costner and the great body of work he has behind him. And not only the body of work, but the westerns that he's done, like Dances with Wolves. Wonderful stuff that he's created. It brought in this audience that has been watching him, I think, for a very long time. And then I think it's bled into the younger crowd, which has really been cool to see over the last couple of years. There are more and more younger people coming up to me and talking about this show than there were initially. I mean, I was at a high school football game the other day here in Florida, and I was shocked that 16-year-olds, 14- and 18-year-olds, male and female, are watching the show and are blown away and love it. It wasn't that way initially. When you're out in public and people recognize you as the guy who plays Rip, does anyone ever come up to you and want to fight? No. Actually, quite the opposite. If anything, guys have been very respectful, and women have been like, they want to get under my arm and take a picture. No, it's been nothing but class. And I have to say, I've been impressed with the outpour of compliments and the love for that character. He's not somebody that Taylor and I thought, oh well, people, men and women, are just going to love this guy. I think that's been a happy surprise for us both. and to see the response in the public to the character, for me personally, it's just been a real blessing, and I'm very appreciative. Your father is Wings Hauser, an actor who has attracted a cult following for his action movies and has also appeared in everything from Norman Jewison's A Soldier's Story to Norman Mailer's Tough Guys Don't Dance. I know your parents divorced when you were quite young, but how old were you when you realized what your father did for a living? That's a good question. I think I was about 9 or 10 years old, something like that. Yeah, I saw him on TV and I didn't know he was my dad. I waited for the finish of the film and I saw Wings Hauser in the credits. So I went into my mom's room and I said, "Hey, Mom, I just saw a guy on TV. His name's Wings Hauser." And she looked at me and went, "Wow." And I said, "Yeah, I saw this guy." And she goes, "Yeah, well, let's talk about that." And so she explained to me who he was. And that's how I found out about my dad. Have you talked much with your father about Yellowstone? Yeah, absolutely. He's a huge fan of the show and he is obviously very proud of what I've done him. He's an old cowboy after all. Our family, the Hauser side of the family, are all Montanans, so it's very close to him. We have family in Helena and Livingstone and all over the state. Finally, back in 2004, you made a movie called Paparazzi, produced by Mel Gibson, in which you played Beau Laramie, an up-and-coming actor who goes hunting for tabloid photographers who nearly killed his family in a car crash while following him to take pictures. In real life, have you ever been in a situation where you wanted to go Beau Laramie on some paparazzi? I'll tell you a funny story. First, no is the answer to the question, but years ago, I had my oldest son with me when we went to the store. And I was getting out of my car, so I was totally oblivious to them being there. But I turned around, and this guy was there taking pictures of me and my son. And my kid was a baby, so I looked at him, and I stopped. And he pulled his camera down and looked at me, and he goes, "Oh, shit." I go, "What?" And he goes, "You just gave me the Beau Laramie look." And he ran off. And that was really the last time I think they ever messed with me. They stayed away, and I've been lucky in that way. Here are a few other film and TV offerings that should interest CNI readers this fall and winter. The Power of the Dog. Benedict Cumberbatch has been generating awards buzz since director Jane Campion's Western drama received a 4-minute standing ovation in September at the Venice Film Festival. Based on the 1967 novel by Thomas Savage, the film showcases Cumberbatch as Phil Burbank, a wealthy but rough-hewn 1920s Montana rancher who strongly disapproves, very strongly, when his more gentle-natured brother George marries the widowed Rose Gordon and brings her and Rose's young son Peter back to the family homestead. Keith Carradine, Adam Beach, and Francis Conroy co-star. Opens in limited theatrical release November 17th and streams December 1st on Netflix. Jockey. Clifton Collins Jr. also has been touted as a Best Actor contender for his compelling performance in director Clint Bentley's indie drama as Jackson, an aging jockey who sets his sights on winning one last championship with the help of a supportive trainer and a promising horse. But he's distracted from his dream when a budding young jockey shows up and claims to be his son. Old Henry. Add another hopeful to the Oscar mix. Veteran character actor Tim Blake Nelson, who has wowed film festival audiences with his cunningly complex portrayal of the title character in director Patsy Panseroli's gritty western. Henry McCarty, a taciturn widowed farmer, would prefer to hide the messy details of his violent past from his young son Wyatt. He doesn't go looking for trouble. Indeed, he consciously avoids it. But trouble comes looking for him when a wounded stranger named Curry shows up on his land, carrying a satchel stuffed with money and claiming he's been pursued by bank robbers posing as lawmen. Henry realizes that he'll have to strap on his shooting irons to defend himself, his son, and his homestead from very bad dudes who don't aim to please. 1883. Yellowstone co-creator and executive producer Taylor Sheridan has come up with a prequel to his smash hit Paramount Network series, which is set to premiere December 19th on Paramount Plus streaming service. It focuses on ancestors of John Dutton in the 21st century paterfamilias as they journey west through the Great Plains. According to the Paramount logline, the series will offer a stark retelling of Western expansion and an intense study of one family fleeing poverty to seek a better future in America's promised land, Montana. Country music power couple Tim McGraw and Faith Hill star as pioneers James and Margaret Dutton, and Sam Elliott plays Shea Brennan, a tough-as-nails cowboy who's leading a group of settlers from Texas. I'm Juanita. Director Matthew Walker's warts-and-all portrait of an Australian country singer determined to become a living legend focuses on Juanita Batayar, a.k.a. Juanita, the self-proclaimed Queen of Honky Tonk. At 46, she realizes that after 24 years as a performer, she needs to find more high-profile stages than the pubs and clubs in her native New South Wales town of Tamworth. So she's ready to fulfill a long-cherished dream by traveling to Nashville and recording a record. The question is Nashville ready for this boisterous force of nature? At the ready, just 10 miles from the U.S.-Mexico border, Horizon High School in El Paso, Texas, is home to one of the region's largest law enforcement education programs and one of this country's largest immigrant populations. For many, a career in the police force, Border Patrol, or DEA, is an opportunity for a stable, middle-class life and a shot at the American dream. Director Maisie Crowe's fascinating documentary, which was warmly embraced by critics at the 2021 Sundance Film Festival, follows three Mexican-American teens who are members of the school's Criminal Justice Club, where they train for no-knock drug raids, hostage negotiations, and active shooter scenarios in the school hallways. But as the students strive toward starting law enforcement careers, they question whether the realities of these jobs may be at odds with the people they hold most dear. Apache Junction. If you missed the latest Western from CNI Movie Award-winning director Justin Lee during its brief theatrical run, don't fret. It's still widely accessible on digital media platforms. Country music great and occasional actor Trace Adkins, soon to be seen as the star of the Fox TV series Monarch, once again gets his cowboy on here, this time as Captain Hensley, a mean galoot who runs the titular haven for outlaws. Scout Taylor Compton co-stars as Abigail Angel, a big city reporter who journeys to Apache Junction in search of notorious killers and thieves to write about. The bad news? She finds more than she can handle. The good news? Gunslinger Jericho Ford comes to her aid when he isn't busy tending to other bloody business. Cry Macho. You can also catch up with Clint Eastwood's latest effort as director star, a gritty drama that the seemingly indestructible superstar completed at the ripe young age of 91. Eastwood plays Mike Milo, a former rodeo star and washed-up horse breeder, who's hired in 1978 by his ex-boss, Howard Polk, to bring Polk's young son, Rafo, home and away from the boy's alcoholic mom. Cruising rural Mexico on their back way to Texas, Mike and Rafo face an unexpectedly challenging journey, during which the world-weary horseman gets his last best shot at redemption through teaching the boy what it means to be a good man. Big Jake versus Billy Jack. In 1971, traditional and revisionist westerns battled for box office supremacy by David Hofstede. 50 years ago, if you were in the mood for a western, there was probably one playing somewhere in your neighborhood, but it might not be the kind you were expecting. In 1971, the genre was in the midst of a transition in which new visions of the Old West clashed with more traditional fare featuring stars audiences had revered for decades. John Wayne, still tall in the saddle, 32 years after attaining stardom in Stagecoach, was enjoying a career renaissance after winning the Oscar in 1970 for True Grit. In Big Jake, he was joined by his most beloved female co-star in Maureen O'Hara, his two sons Patrick and Ethan, and old friends like Harry Carey Jr. Wayne played a rancher on a quest to rescue his kidnapped grandson, played by Ethan. Reviews were mixed, scarcely distinguished, but certainly enjoyable, was the Los Angeles Times assessment, but a rousing climactic shootout sent Duke fans home happy. Big Jake earned about twice in ticket sales what it cost to make, a success by any standard, but one that paled next to the year's second highest-grossing film, Billy Jack. The vision of writer-director star Tom Laughlin, it expanded the legend of a character introduced 4 years earlier in an otherwise forgettable biker flick called Born Losers. Billy Jack was a Native American, Green Beret, Vietnam War veteran, who preached nonviolence before beating his enemies senseless with a Korean martial art called Hapkido. Critics yawned and shrugged, but there was something in this reluctant Indian warrior and in Laughlin's laconic but effective performance that resonated with younger viewers who also felt like outcasts in tumultuous times. Native American author Sherman Alexie recalled his whole tribe piling into a couple of vans and driving 6 hours to see the film in Spokane, Washington. Every Indian remembers Billy Jack. I mean, back in the day, Indians worshipped Billy Jack, Alexie wrote in a 1998 article in the Los Angeles Times. We Indians cheered as Billy Jack fought for us, for every single Indian. Of course, we conveniently ignored the fact that Tom Laughlin, the actor who played Billy Jack, was definitely not Indian. Made for a minuscule $800,000 budget, Billy Jack would earn $32.5 million and nearly $100 million internationally. And so it went in 1971. For every old-school western like Catlow, starring Yul Brynner and based on a Louis L'Amour novel, there was the Zachariah, billed as the first electric western for the inclusion of several rock songs performed by Country Joe and the Fish. Revenge stories in the classic tradition like Shootout with Gregory Peck and One More Train to Rob gave longtime western fans the fix they needed. The Hired Hand, directed at a snail's pace with a cynical sneer from Peter Fonda, likely sent many home shaking their heads. Burt Lancaster worked both sides of the trail that year. Valdez Is Coming was a fine adaptation of an Elmore Leonard tale, while Lawman, in which he played a marshal as morally ambiguous as the men he pursued, blurred the line between good guys and bad guys. But Lancaster made both films worth seeing. Perhaps the year's most controversial release was McCabe and Mrs. Miller, starring Warren Beatty as a gambler with higher aspirations and Julie Christie as his drug-addicted partner in a bordello. Director Robert Altman himself called it an anti-Western for its deliberate shredding of some tried-and-true conventions of the genre, and the film still stirs up arguments among Western fans 50 years after its debut. It's not often given to a director to make a perfect film. Some spend their lives trying, but always fall short. Robert Altman has made a dozen films that can be called great in one way or another, but one of them is perfect, and that one is McCabe and Mrs. Miller, rhapsodized Robert Ebert. The venerable 10-volume motion picture guide offered a different assessment. This jumbled, mumbling, fumbling film is a cult production with those who identify with failure and backstabbing and those with no redeeming virtues whatsoever. The American Film Institute is in Ebert's camp. It named the film the 8th greatest Western of all time in 2008. And Christie earned an Academy Award Best Actress nomination. No wonder some moviegoers of the day approached every new release with trepidation. Perhaps some of them figured they had better odds seeing one of the European imports, especially as new arrivals were still opening nearly every month since Sergio Leone and Clint Eastwood kicked off the stateside spaghetti western craze with A Fistful of Dollars in 1964. Sure, they were a little quirky and sometimes badly dubbed, but they usually delivered an action on action and atmosphere. Leone was back in 1971 with the underrated and unfortunately titled Duck, You Sucker. But 50 years ago, Lee Van Cleef may have been the busiest actor in Spain with 3 new releases, Bad Man's River, Captain Apache, and Return of Zapata. Despite the changes in tone and provocative nature of the Westerns of a half century ago, it's hard not to look back with envy on a time when the volume of new releases rivaled any other movie genre. This was also the year of Hanny Calder with Raquel Welch, one of the films Quentin Tarantino cited as an inspiration for Kill Bill. The delightful comedy Support Your Local Gunfighter with James Garner, back in the cowboy con man role he honed to perfection in Maverick. And The Last Rebel, a Civil War era Western starring New York Jets quarterback Joe Namath. If all else failed, you could always stay home and watch Gunsmoke.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading an article from True West Magazine's archives, October 1967 edition. Treasures of Galveston Bay. Buccaneers, settlers, and Mexican troops crisscrossed this land, and all had moments of extremity when their wealth had to be buried immediately or lost forever. By Carol Lewis. There are more different treasures to be found around the vicinity of Galveston Bay than in any other comparable area in the world. And why not? This was the domain where the infamous pirate chieftain Jean Lafitte held sway. His base at Galveston Island was perfectly located for his many pirating forays upon the rich Spanish fleet, which carried vast fortunes of gold and silver from Mexico to Spain. Their trade routes could go nowhere else than through this gauntlet provided by Lafitte and his ships, manned by more than 1,000 buccaneers. What a tremendous store of prizes Captain Lafitte must have captured. One Spanish galleon alone, the Santa Rosa, captured on June 12, 1816, yielded silver ingots valued at over $2 million. Lafitte also had a very profitable sideline, selling slaves. One of his best customers was Jim Bowie, that gallant Texan who died defending the Alamo, and whose name is known worldwide for his design of the famous Bowie knife. It was estimated that Bowie made over $60,000 a year from selling slaves he had bought from Lafitte. With the money derived from selling slaves and the wealth of booty plundered from over 300 Spanish ships, this buccaneer captain of Galveston Island must have amassed a tremendous fortune. If the pirates did not bring treasures to the island, the hurricanes did. From Padre Island to Sabine Pass, the Gulf Coast was strewn with the wrecks of many treasure-laden ships, which were sunk by the fierce Gulf storms. An early map, drawn during the Galveston era of filibuster, Colonel Perry, in 1816, shows the wrecks of two vessels not more than 300 yards offshore, just south of Punta Bolivar, now Bolivar Point, and another wreck about midway between Punta Culebra, the east end of Galveston Island, and Pelican Island. These ships and their cargoes were never recovered. In 1822, Stephen Austin purchased the schooner Lively to transport 300 families and their belongings to his colony in Texas. It was wrecked not far from San Luis Pass off the western end of Galveston Island. According to the papers of Mirabeau Bonaparte Lamar, the crew was saved, but the provisions and cargo were all lost. What a cargo that must have been! In those days, the many modern methods of retrieving sunken treasure were unknown, and such cargoes were given up. The Lively's rich cargo still waits to be recovered. On December 22, 1834, Robert Kleberg, whose heirs own the famous King Ranch in South Texas, and another early pioneer named Von Roeder, were shipwrecked 60 yards offshore and cast upon the beach midwest down Galveston Island, where three trees were seen. This was most probably Lafitte's Grove. These two wealthy Texas settlers had their ship, the Sabine, well provided with clothes, money, and equipment. This rich cargo still awaits a finder. Dr. James Long and over 200 filibusters lived on Bolivar Point, just opposite Lafitte's fort on Galveston Island. His wife, Jane, became known as the Mother of Texas because she faithfully endured the hardships of such a life. While Lafitte was after his prey in the Gulf, Long and his henchmen seized some of the pirates' small boats which had been left in the harbor at Galveston. In a letter to General E.W. Ripley at Louisiana in 1820, Long described this action and also mentioned the presence of some men of Mascati who knew of $130,000 in specie buried nearby. Long was killed later, and the $130,000 in specie, worth much more now, was never found. Pirate booty was not the only treasure to be found around Galveston Bay, for this area was the area settled by wealthy plantation owners from the South who moved all their belongings to the new land of Texas where they might set up larger dynasties. Because of the menace from Indians, desperados, and Mexicans, these settlers kept their money and jewels hidden or buried around their homesteads. Sometimes the owners died suddenly or were killed, and the secret of their treasure location died with them. Sometimes, when danger threatened, these settlers were forced to flee from their homes. There was no time to dig up their valuables, so they left them buried, knowing that their cash would be safely hidden until their return. Some never came back. Deaths or other series of events prevented the return of many. Others, after moving to a safer and more comfortable community, decided never again to face the terrors and hardships of early Texas living and gave up their homesteads, along with their buried valuables. The grandmother of Ivy Ilfrey, who lived near Cedar Bayou in those days, said that since there was no banks at that settlement, everyone there buried his wealth for safekeeping. There are probably many of these lost treasure caches to be found. One resident of Piney Point, west of Houston, buried $18,000 in gold during the Civil War so the Union troops would not find it. As the war progressed, his memory of the cache's location grew dimmer, and when the war was over, he was utterly confused as to the exact location. The Yankees did not get his gold, but neither did he. In 1929, a construction crew erecting a filling station at Houston on the corner of Washington Avenue and Houston Street found a pot containing $2,000 in gold buried in the ground there, mute testimony to the treasure-burying custom of the early settlers. Colonel Ham Washington buried $1 million in gold to prevent its capture by the Union Army. His fortune has not been found yet. The biggest threat, however, to the settlers around Galveston Bay was the terrible marauding army of Mexico in 1836. Led by General Santa Anna, this army of more than 5,000 troops had already captured the town of San Antonio, destroying the Alamo Fortress and killing all of its defenders, among whom were Jim Bowie, Davy Crockett, and William B. Travis. Colonel Fannin and his entire command at Goliad were massacred, and the Mexican force was on its way to capture the fleeing officials of the newly formed Texan government. They were camped at New Washington, now Morgan's Point, on the shore of Galveston Bay. Surely every Texas homesteader hid or buried his prized possessions in the face of such an onslaught. One of these colonists was Enoch Brinson, who had a boat landing, Brinson's Point, on San Jacinto Bay near Morgan's Point. His home was located just west of La Porte in a grove of trees right in the line of march of the approaching Mexican army. Being an early settler, Brinson had most certainly built up quite a fortune. How much of it did he hide from the Mexicans? How many of Enoch Brinson's prized possessions might still lie buried around that grove of trees? A treasure hunter would do well to explore that spot. Santa Anna called himself the Napoleon of the West, but he met his Waterloo just a few miles north of Enoch Brinson's homestead. In the afternoon of the 21st of April in 1836, General Sam Houston and his ragtag band of 783 Texans surprised a sleeping Mexican army of 1,150 troops, which was camped upon the plains of St. Hyacinth, San Jacinto. After an incredibly short but fierce 18 minutes, the Mexican army was completely routed. Santa Anna was captured and surrendered to a victorious Texas Republic. But one thing was missing. The Mexican army was surprisingly devoid of funds. $12,000 was supposed to have been found and divided among the Texans, but several soldiers reported that this was not so. As a matter of fact, the only wealth confiscated from the Mexicans was a small amount of gold picked from the fillings in the teeth of dead soldiers. Did this huge army travel without money to pay its troops? Did it not have means with which to buy supplies along the way? Or did it loot and plunder for its needed provisions? If it did loot and plunder, what happened to the gold, silver, jewels, and other valuables taken from the helpless Texans? The remainder of the Mexican army, more than 2,500 troops, was encamped around Mrs. Powell's Tavern, about 20 leagues west of the battlefield. In charge was General Vicente Filosia, who had to beg his government for money in order to finance his retreat back to Mexico. Santa Anna, therefore, must have taken all the money and loot with him to San Jacinto. A personal bodyguard of Santa Anna later told that the general buried a valuable pay chest full of gold just before the battle at San Jacinto, at a spot near the battleground, when he realized that a skirmish was imminent. All the other gold and loot was disposed of in quite a devious manner. None of this hidden fortune was ever found. buried pirate booty, sunken Spanish galleons, rich shipwrecked cargoes, hidden Mexican gold, forgotten treasures. These are the many lost fortunes around Galveston Bay that are ready for the taking. Recent progressive development in transistorized electronic equipment has produced some very sensitive metal detecting devices. The easy availability of such equipment opens the exciting field of treasure hunting to everyone in a manner that is most fascinating. Who does not feel his blood tingle and thrill to the sound of the words buried treasure? Now it can be searched for easily with the use of these scientific instruments. The night before Jean Lafitte departed from Galveston Island, he was seen walking to and fro upon the floors of his Maison Rouge, murmuring something about my treasure, the three trees. He must surely have been distraught at the thought of leaving his island fortress and possibly a little out of his head. So those who heard him thought he had unknowingly revealed the location of one of his treasures. The three trees, Lafitte's Grove, midway down the island, three windswept trees mark the site of an earlier bloody battle between Lafitte's pirates and a tribe of Kararankawa Indians. After 3 days of fighting, seven pirates and 60 Indians were killed. The defeated Indians left the island and never came back. This battlefield was soon known as Lafitte's Grove. Upon hearing about treasure, the three trees, those henchmen Lafitte left behind wasted no time and rushed to Lafitte's Grove to recover some of their hard-earned booty. They searched and dug diligently, finding only a few scattered gold doubloons, until suddenly one of their shovels struck a solid object buried deep in the sand. The shoveling became more frantic as a large, brass-handled wooden box gradually appeared out of the excavation. This was it. Booty for all, Lafitte's treasure. The excited pirates quickly broke open the cover of the chest in anticipation of the riches therein, but were amazed at what they saw. Only the remains of the corpse of a woman were lying in the chest. No gold, no silver. Shocked and disappointed, they continued digging around the grove, but nothing else was found. Did not Lafitte bury his wife Madeleine Rigaud, whom he could have considered his treasure? Was this what he was referring to on that restless night back at the Maison Rouge? Or was it possible that there might be some other treasure at some of the other trees? Strange markings were found on some trees near Seabrook, where Lafitte was known to have anchored his ships, and there are some people who believe that Lafitte hid a treasure near the three large trees on the high banks of the Lone Oak Bayou. There is another story of Lafitte's returning to Galveston Island shortly after he left to bury a chest full of gold and jewels at the grove. For a marker, he buried a brass surveying rod known as a Jacob's staff and left about a foot of it sticking out of the sand. It is possible that the blowing sands soon covered the rod, and those who were to look later for treasure at the grove never ran across the marker. The three trees at Lafitte's Grove were destroyed by a hurricane in 1915. After a number of years, new sprouts grew out of the gnarled old roots, and today quite a few small trees stand at that spot. The grove is located about 50 yards east of Stewart's Road, about 12 miles down the island adjoining the W. Ostermeyer property. A State of Texas historical marker can be found among the weeds and bushes that grow around the trees. Within a short walking distance from Lafitte's Grove, a farmer named Bill Zingelman was plowing in a rented cabbage patch one September day in 1937. He saw something shining in the dirt and, with a closer look, discovered it to be a silver dollar. Scratching around further in the soil, Zingelman found many more loosely buried coins. Finally, he unearthed a whole glass jar full of silver coins. In it were old French and Spanish coins and several American quarters, half dollars and dollars. The coins dated from 1822 to 1897, which places the burial date of this cache at a time in history when there was no threat of Indians, Mexicans, Union troops, or the like. Just another buried treasure that someone had forgotten about. There is also the story of an old recluse woman who lived out on the island and who buried a jar full of jewels near her house. She died suddenly from a severe illness while she was at home alone in her place. The secret of the hiding place of her wealth died with her. The jewels were never found. Early in 1836, some Galveston Island inhabitants were looking for building materials around some wreckage, piles of ship's timbers, which had drifted up on the sand dunes of West Beach. They had to dig out some of the heavier tenders, and about 3 feet below the surface, they came upon a large quantity of silver plate. Greatly excited, they dug up the whole area, and their further explorations uncovered 3 gold Spanish doubloons. A monstrous September hurricane in 1818 forced Lafitte's fleet of ships to seek the shelter of his harbor. From all parts of the Gulf, they ran before the wind in a race for the protection of Galveston Island. The hurricane hit with the fury that would not allow any of the ships to unload the prizes which had been captured out in the Gulf. The pirates were more concerned with their lives and hurriedly took refuge in the fort. Most of the vessels were overturned and sunk in the harbor. Several broke loose from their moorings and were driven around on Virginia Point and destroyed there with their gold and silver booty. The bottom of Galveston Bay still holds the wealth of cargo which went down with these ships and the many other prize-laden vessels which met ill fate upon the treasure island of Galveston. In the mid-1800s, at the huge Jackson Ranch on Double Bayou, there appeared 2 seafaring men who asked permission to camp along the bay shore for a few days of fishing. Permission being granted, these practical-looking characters drove their wagon off and camped along the bay shore in the lower end of the pasture. Several days later, they left the ranch in a hurry, driving their wagon away at full speed as if they were being chased. They did not even stop at the ranch house as they went by. Their departure seemed so suspicious that an investigation was made of their campgrounds. Several freshly dug holes were discovered in the vicinity of the shoreline, and in the largest hole was left an impression of a large square chest which evidently had been taken out. The 2 seafaring men were never seen again. They apparently had found what they were looking for. If it were a treasure chest, would it not be possible that this same area might contain other treasures? Only the vanished buccaneer, Jean Lafitte, would have had the answer. His failure to return leaves a mystery as to how much pirate gold still lies behind and buried around Galveston Bay. Lafitte, when ordered to leave Galveston, was supposed to have loaded his flagship, the Pride, with 5 bearskins of gold and sailed somewhere into the back reaches of Galveston Bay to bury them. His ship ran aground and developed such a leak that it sank in the mouth of a small lake. The heavily loaded ship settled down into the muddy bottom before the gold could be taken off. This treasure was never recovered. In the summer of 1849, B.J. Krieger and Leo T. Benn advertised in a Houston newspaper that they had a metal-detecting instrument and offered to share the proceeds with anyone who would furnish them with a good buried treasure location. E.H. Sherman of Wallaceville remembered that his grandfather had discovered a sunken ship in Lake Miller in 1883. It was hidden just below the surface of the water and snagged onto some logs, which he was floating down to the Trinity River. Sherman's sister, Mrs. E.H. Clark, recalled her father taking her to the sunken ship several times, and that one day he marked its location by driving a large iron spike into an oak tree. Sherman and his sister got in touch with the 2 treasure hunters, and after a 2-month search, they finally located the ship, less than 200 feet from the bank of a 20-foot-wide channel which connected Lake Charlotte with the Trinity River. The hulk of this ship had sunk over 8 feet into the quicksand-like mud of Lake Miller. By using a 10.5-foot-long pipe as a probe, they were able to stake out its outline. The craft measured roughly 75 feet long by about 35 feet wide, a measurement that could have fit the Pride. John Lafitte of St. Joseph, Missouri, who said he was a descendant of Lafitte, heard about this discovery and came to Houston to claim his right to anything that was found. He had information that, besides gold, the Pride also had aboard a 42,000-word manuscript written by Lafitte about his exploits. He seemed more interested in the manuscript than in the 5 bearskins of gold. But while the treasure hunting party was turning a deaf ear to this claimant, the state of Texas turned the lock on any further digging in the lake. It seems that the proper leasing procedure of state-owned lands had not been complied with, and the expedition was ordered to stop its exploration. As far as anyone knows, the treasure of gold and history which may lie beneath the sunken ship timbers in Lake Miller have never been recovered. Across Trinity Bay, on the west side of the shore, at the Morgan's Point ferryboat landing, a state highway crew came upon some old ship's timbers in March 1950 while dredging in the water for a ferry parking area. A solid pine keel, about 65 feet long, and some ribs were pulled out of the mire. The fact that these timbers contained no nails but were put together with square, handmade spikes placed the ship's vintage back to the time of Lafitte. Again, the size of this vessel makes it possible that this might have been the wreckage of the Pride. If so, the 5 bearskins of gold and Lafitte's manuscript may still be waiting in the mud at Morgan's Point. A Spanish schooner was trapped and sunk by the Gulf pirates up Old River, north of Trinity Bay, which had aboard a cannon filled with gold. Lacking modern-day diving equipment, the pirates were never able to retrieve the heavy gold-filled gun. There are stories of other pirate plunder being buried along the cliff-like banks of the river. The many caves and holes along those banks testify that someone is still trying to find their loot. There is a legend of several large strong boxes filled with gold being buried near Barber's Hill. These have never been found, yet the pockmarked fields around this area give evidence that treasure hunters will not easily give up their search for that fortune. The vicinities of Goose Creek and Cedar Bayou were known to be some of Lafitte's favorite haunts, and the mouth of the San Jacinto River was used as a place for repairing and watering his ships. There were no shipyards available in those days. In order to repair the bottom of a ship's hull, it had to be taken to quiet waters where it could be beached close to shore. The crew would then fasten lines to the tops of the masts and stretch them to a gang of men on shore who would have heave slowly on them. The leverage thus applied would careen or lay the ship over on its side. The bottom would then be above water and ready to be repaired or cleaned. Close to the San Jacinto River, careening place, was an old river channel where speedboat races are now held. In the southeastern part of this body of water, the pirates supposedly sank a brass cannon filled with gold. Nearby, on the north shore of Lost Lake, ruins of fortress walls and cannon emplacements can still be found, mute evidence of the pirate domain. In 1875, an Englishman named John White and several other men came to this area with an old map showing the location of a buried treasure. Everything on the map checked out with the geography thereabouts, except that the main marker was missing. It was a cedar tree with 2 crossed pegs driven into it. There was no such cedar tree to be found. Uncle Bill Miller, who was a longtime resident of Old River, remembered that when he was a boy, he had cut down a cedar tree which had 2 crossed pegs in it. One day when he was out coon hunting, he offered to show White the location of the tree if White would show him the map and split the treasure 50-50. The Englishman refused, hoping eventually to come upon the remains of the tree, and thus keep all the treasure to himself. He searched for many years and finally died without finding anything. There is another legend of two cannons being filled with gold and heaved into the Buffalo Bayou near Lynchburg, and the deep waters at the mouth of the Cedar Bayou are known to rush over the final resting place of several other gold-filled cannons. But the prize pirate plunder, which captures the imagination of every treasure hunter, is yet to be found. The treasure chests of Jean Lafitte.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.